And we're back. Welcome to No Direction, your Pathfinder news, reviews, and interviews podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param. And today, I'm joined by...
I'm Vanessa Hoskins, also known as Vicky.
And... I'm Luis Loza, and I'm also known as Luis Loza.
Indeed. Thank you. Indeed. Thank you so much for joining us. For those of you who do not know, V and Luis are joining us as new permanent hosts of No Direction. So expect their wonderful smiling faces and dulcet tones on every episode for the foreseeable future, at least.
Wait, how permanent? Are we streaming forever on this channel and can't
this
get off?
This stream never ends. This is the forever stream. We are going to do this in real time.
When you said do this forever, I thought you meant like on Monday nights, not.
Yes, yes. This
forever.
Is the Monday that never ends. With the turn off the stream, we never have to release the episode. Anything I can do to avoid editing, Vanessa. Anything I can do.
Oh, fantastic.
But for those of you joining us that do give Luis and Vanessa a nice welcome if you're live in chat. And we will, of course, be answering questions from chat throughout the episode. And we are super hyped to do so. But for today, we've got a very special topic to open things up. And that is indeed breakdown. I'm tongue-tied today. Breakdown of Monsters of Myth. And I lost Monsters where I took my book. I had the book. I brought it out here specifically to go hug
it. It's broken free. It's escaped.
Oh my gosh.
But was it ever really here to begin with, Luis?
I don't know. I mean, I think this new technology where Paizo has the books come back so we can sell them again and double our profits has been working out great.
Yes, just Eldritch errata. Is that the correct term for it?
Yes.
But before we
Jaina B says it's a mimic of myth. It just grew legs and walked away looking for something to eat.
And before we jump straight into breakdown and into the gloriousness that is a Brain Lost Omens book, why don't you all talk? How do you like being new hosts? I mean, that's a pretty big deal. You're the new host of No Direction, the flagship show of the No Direction Network, and the longest running Pathfinder podcast in the world.
I mean, I like the new host.
I'm rather fond.
I was going to say, so far I've been having a great time as a host. It's been pretty easy.
This has been the best 3 minutes hosting any show of my entire life.
I managed to not forget my name when I introduced myself, so I think we're doing great so far.
And if there is like the slightest chance that somebody might not know who the two of you are, could you start introducing yourself? V, introduce yourself and tell us why you're awesome.
Sure. I'm a sometimes nonsensical woman who writes Pathfinder and Starfinder stuff. And other finder, no, those are the only two finders. Other things, wow, this is coming out bad. I mostly write adventures, and I also write mechanics, and I write a bunch of silly stuff, and I am the kind of person who's always doing something new and bizarre because I can, and also being a little bit of a rules lawyer on the developers who are like, do this thing, and I'm like, well, you didn't say not to do this other thing, so let's just try that out. And so far, it's worked out pretty good for me.
And Luis.
Well, I have this pretty well practiced, so I think I could say I'm Luis, and I'm a developer at Paizo working on the Pathfinder Lost Omens line. I've been playing tabletop RPGs for over 15 years, and I've written for dozens of Pathfinder products. I am also the GM for Valiant. I write Monsters Physique blog on the No Direction Network, and I guess I'm also one of the hosts of No Direction.
You did such a better job than me.
And I lost Luis?
No, we got Luis. No. He's good. We just lost you.
Oh, wonderful.
You did such a better job than me, Luis.
I have, 30 episodes of Legend Lore worth of practice at this point.
I don't know. I always forget things. If I try to list everything, I'm going to forget something, and then someone's going to be like, you forgot that thing. And I could be like, fine, I'm the author of Vellum and Lace, a PG-13 sex comedy taking place in the city of the center of the world, now on Pathfinder Infinite. And then I would just keep listing things. It would take too long.
And not to mention that the two of you are also prolific members of the No Direction Network and two of my favorite people to hang out with on stream or off.
Aww.
I saw the picture that you used for the announcement with featured V and I. And it's like, oh, it'd be great to get together at another con and do all three of us. For right. A banner, and you know that'll surely happen very soon, I'm sure.
Oh gosh.
And the Fire Nation attacked, or the Fire Army, according to this book.
Yeah, Army of Fire. I know
those
Army
guys. Of Fire with lizard spears and wonderful
Do we want to mention
verbalness?
Before we do any further breakdown, do we want to mention that as the developer of the Lost Omens line, I've worked directly on this book, and thus we have to announce I worked on the book and wrote for the book and stuff.
Indeed. This is a breakdown and not officially a review, is that we can't really review the book because Luis kind of made it. And
I feel like it's going to be hard to review books moving forward.
This has kind of been true for a long time on the KD Network, because
it really has.
Somebody on the network has worked on just about every book y'all have released for the past few years. And so this is a pretty standard disclaimer. And this is where we like to remind you all that we are the completely biased Pathfinder News Reviews and Interviews podcast, a tagline that we have need to pick back up again that we were using a few years ago.
Completely biased.
Enthusiasts. We do this because we love it. Bona fides and disclaimers. Lots of people worked on it. I didn't work on this book. V, did you work on this book?
This is one I did not work on.
Okay. That's not the answer I expected, because you work on just about everything anymore.
Well, I did for a while. We're entering the phase of releases where I was either for one reason or another, unable to work on the books. And so there was a period of time that I didn't get to freelance. And this is all those books are now coming out. And so it's happening.
V had a credit on the Absalom book, though. So
yes.
There was another release that just happened anyway, if you still want to see some of Vanessa's writing.
And of course, Kitsune Warlock is claiming that there is a bias war between us and Arcane Mark. To be fair, 100% of Arcane Mark works for Paizo. and only 33 1/3% get paychecks from Paizo on the regular, though I think we've all been paid by Paizo.
At some point. Yeah.
All right, so let's drop into this myth.
Okay.
Pathfinder Lawman's Monsters of Myth. This is a return to form for what was the Lost Omens inspiration, I think. What I mean is, this feels a whole lot like a Pathfinder Chronicles book from the day. Specifically, this thing immediately gave me Class Monsters Revisited vibes. The moment I picked it up. And indeed, there was a Monsters of Legend Chronicles book from back in the day, too. And this is sort of this felt like going home and reading these those soft cover GM. And indeed, even though it is a hardcover book, because I didn't break my spine lifting it compared to recent Pathfinder releases, it felt like I was reading a soft cover book again, despite it being 128 pages.
Yeah, the comparisons to Classic Monsters and Mythic Monsters Revisited and all those, I think there were 10 books in that whole series, is definitely it's intentional. In fact, some of these monsters came from some of those older books as well. They just kind of got updated. So yeah, it's definitely let's give you a deep dive on one specific monster and have it campaign ready, or at least serve as hopefully inspiration to get a campaign all on its own at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to say what this book is not. This is not a bestiary, even though it is a book about monsters. There are 20 monsters and their friends included in this book.
Right.
A couple of stat blocks for the big monster itself and some accoutrement. Or in the place of the kaiju, absolutely no creature stat blocks and just the horrible things that being around those creatures.
Yeah, not here's how you fight and kill them. Just there's a bunch of them and they're scary. Good luck.
Yeah.
One thing that is interesting. I was gonna say you said it's not a bestiary, and it kind of is. I stumbled on reading through this, is it fills this weird liminal space, right? It reminds me of a campaign setting book where you're talking about, oh, here's all about Taldor or something. Here's Cheliax for the 18th time. But it's like that, but also a bestiary if they were sort of combined. So yes, there's only 20 main stars of this and there's the big monsters and 125 pages of content. But at the same time, it's it's kind of laid out sort of like if you had a bestiary and you took any of these big monsters that had a big two-page spread and said, what if we just gave them a chapter? and just kept talking about them. But then in addition, there's all of these campaign hooks like you would get in one of these setting books. It's like, ooh, GMs could do something with this. And that's where I say it fits this weird liminal space for the GM who like wants to do homebrew, but doesn't want to have to homebrew everything. And wants a starting place, right? Wants you to say, hey, here's something cool you could do. And then they say, oh, okay, I could do something cool with that. And then they start working on it. As opposed to the GMs who either just want a fully formed adventure and go run an adventure path or some society game, or GMs who say, I'm just going to grab a bestiary and open to a page and that's what you're going to fight. And it fits right in the between those, which is honestly kind of a surprise for me because there aren't a lot of products that are like that, pointed at GMs who want to homebrew with assistance, you know, with a little bit of guidance.
What's your take on it, Louise, as the person made it?
It was definitely meant to not be the like, hey, we'll handle all the heavy lifting you like an adventure, a module and AP would. But it's definitely more than, I guess it's a lot of different things for a lot of different people. On the GM side, I think V really covered it pretty well. It's very much a tool to kind of ease the homebrew thing, but it's also almost a catalog for players who want to find a campaign to do. If you are a player and start reading through this, in theory, hopefully if we've done our job right, you will find a thing and be like, oh, the Melfish monster, I like that thing. And then you take it to your GM and say, can we fight this thing? And then they come up with an adventure, right? You kind of set the goal that you want as a player. Or it could be, hey, I see the cool magical sword that Fafn here has, right? Mm-hmm. I want to get. So UDN, I want to get the sword. Well, you're gonna have to earn it. Obviously, you have to go and steal it from his lair or kill him or something. It sets up a lot of back and forth, I think, at a table with a GM and a players where they can decide, oh, we want this, or how does this sound? And then they can kind of decide together, all right, I think we'll go with, you know, we'll go with Fafn here and we'll tell a story about the new Linorn Slayers to be and all that stuff. And, you know, it's lots of little campaigns or adventures or even one shots just kind of ready to deploy whenever that either side of the table can decide, all right, now we want to do this. Let's go for it.
And one of the things I really do like about how the monsters are presented here is that this does, for me, lean more into a campaign setting book than it does a monster book, in that you really lore heavy front end and usually an in-character introduction to each of the monsters. In the very first monster, it's literally it talking. And that threw me for a loop when I was like, I think I'm the last of my kind. What? Why is the monster talking to me now? Is this going to be like the Prince of Truth opening of the Book of the Damned? Because like, it gave me those sorts of vibes. And I do like that, like, Lost Omens Legends and some of the similar books where you've taken this track that varies. One of my favorites indeed was when it took place during the case file.
Oh, for Springhill Jack.
Where like this investigator and all the entries is like him tracking down the legends of Hill Jack. And that's a lot of what these monsters are. These are legendary mythical monsters, in which case there is a lot of lore backing them up, and therefore a lot of reason to present things in that. Then you get some more of the facts about the monster and what is actually, though I'm going to put an asterisk in that and come back to this point for later. And then you, before you even get to the stat blocks, you get the, hey, how do I use this in my game? And more specifically, instead of just, how do I use this in my game, the paragraph or the page, you break it down for every monster. Is breaking down into low level, mid level, and high level. How does this this mythical monster and its followers and its tag-alongs and its influences, how would that affect the game at 1st to 7th level, 8th to 14th, and then 15th to 20th level? And a lot of them, it's basically like the low levels is, you got to survive this monster and deal with the calamities and just like try to hold it together at low levels. And then at the end of it, you might be able to take it. that 20, sure. Or right. My personal favorite, the kaiju. Nope, you can't. You still can't be the kaiju, but yeah, at least you have the best chance to, huh? Yeah, maybe you can put it to sleep.
Yeah. Right. Wonderful. Well, and that's the other thing I like is because you look at like kaiju at the upper end, right? Is they're so powerful, they don't even get stat blocks. You're not going to beat them. But even then you can say, well, what does a low level campaign get to do? And there's, you know, three paragraphs there describing like, here's the kind of stuff that happens when kaiju are around. Here's the kind of things that you can do for this kind of game. So you can say, hey, we're going to run a kaiju adventure. Oh, that's cool. Everyone's level one. Oh, what? I don't even know how we're going to do that. And like, there's a way to do it. That's pretty cool.
And that brings us to one of the first questions from chat that really tie into this discussion. This comes from Kitsune Warlock, Dustin from the network. Serious question. Was there a defined criteria the team used to determine what qualifies as a monster? Or was it a we know it when we see it kind of?
I think for sure it wasn't like a, oh, they have to have an int score of like 6 or lower, right? That wasn't it, because we have dragons who are hyper intelligent and other creatures like that around. So it's not like an intelligence or sapiens ascendant kind of thing. I think really it just broke down to if it's humanoid or not. Humanoids end up covering a lot of things that I think most people would feel aren't monsters. At that point, we're doing an NPC codex, we're doing legend like that. So anything outside of that criteria, I think really worked. And there are creatures that are very humanoid in form, like Desert Howl looks like a person, but then it has huge horns and it's got its, you know, musculature exposed and things like that. So as long as it's not a straight up, oh, this is just a mean elf, or an evil dwarf or something, right? I think anything was game. But there is definitely an element of, you know it when I see it. So something like a dinky ooze wouldn't qualify. It'd have to be an ooze that's really worth being legendary, something that everyone knows. It's like, oh, this, you know, this blob that appears every 100 years and just clears out this valley and eats everything inside of it, you know, might be something like that would qualify. It has to have a story. It has to have notoriety within the world to be considered something to end up in this book.
So what does make a monster a mythical? Like you said, it has to have notoriety. The opening of this, honestly, when I read the opening of this book, I was like, oh, these are the monsters that are influencers and have successful Twitch channels, because like, it's not enough that you be a monster. You've got to be able to keep that story going. And it's not enough that you destroy a town, but people have to be really afraid that you might destroy their town. And like, there really is talk about like how lore and legend and myth build up to give a different take on these monsters.
And it specifically mentions the survivors telling the story, right? Like it Fafnir here wouldn't go around telling everyone I'm the greatest, whatever. It would be the people who tried and failed and then came back. Fafnir here might actually, but like, yeah, you know,
pretty sure he does.
Something like the Melfish monster wouldn't just go around and be like, ah, fear me, you know, give me praise and give me gold and stuff. It's just something that you would hear about, you know, it in the back of a tavern or something, or you'd hear the stories of the army that went to go kill it and only 4 soldiers returned. That's how it keeps that story going.
So does this automatically mean that these, like, oh, we've made the CRs like in the 30s or something? Is that how you've made these monsters?
No. I think you can be legendary. If you look at the one that you mentioned earlier, Spring-Heeled Jack, I think he's level 3 from what I remember. He's a 3rd level creature. And like, if you torment people and become a local legend, you're still mythical in some way. You might just not be mythical known around the whole world, but you mean a lot to the people within your sphere of influence, and that might be enough to earn your monster of myth status.
Right.
I do like it when I saw that Spring-Heeled Jack is like a 1st level party is technically able to take him on, but be careful how you use him. The Melfish beast is like only like CR 6 or 8, and like, oh yeah, that's totally doable, like in a 3-part like mini adventure path would totally be able to handle that. You could easily do these. I did worry that this was definitely to be a book of like, oh yeah, this is a great sense of book, but it's going to be like you know, the old gods and magic, and not gods and magic, deities and demigods, where mm-hmm. we have stat blocks for elder gods for some reason, as if you're ever going to be high enough to fight them.
A CR 35.
And Param, did you ever check out Elder Evils back in third edition? Do you know that book?
No. What's it cool for you?
Elder Evils was a book that had the, it was very much like this, but it even had like encounter maps and stuff, and like mini adventures or mini campaigns written. But it was only for your end game, end of campaign monsters. So it I think it didn't have anything like lower than like CR 18, right? It just had like the high level end of campaign monsters. It had Caius, if you knew Caius from, it had a separate Caius from Age of Worms, technically. So if you didn't want to go through Age of Worms, you had this different thing to do. And that was all cool. And I think it was coming out as 3.5 was coming to an end, which was very fitting, I think. You know, hey, let's wrap up those campaigns. Let's end things here. But it meant that you could only use it if you were going to be playing in a high level campaign or willing to mm-hmm. create characters for this kind of thing. So we wanted to intentionally avoid that in the first place. It's like, we don't want this book to be obsolete or unusable for half, you know, two thirds, four fifths of campaigns out there. How many campaigns are hitting high enough level to take on a level 24 creature? So that's why there was a variety of different levels among the monsters here. So it's like, oh, you can use them at, you can use this book at any level. You can find the right monster. And additionally, then we gave the guidance of like, well, I guess if you really want Fafnir to show up, here's how you do the low level influence kind of stuff.
But how about the reverse? Could you campaign like a supernatural / like mythical Scooby-Doo monster hunter campaign out of a bunch of these monsters?
You probably could.
Yeah, I mean, they all have guidance for all levels of play. So your level three Springheel Jack even has like a, well, at high level, like, what's the point of fighting one Springheel Jack? But here's how you can make it. So like, if you want to end Springheel Jacks once and for all, you chase him into the first world and possibly run into mm-hmm. something that could be even more powerful than the Springheel Jack. And it's like the ultimate one. It might be the Springheel King or something. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. there are suggestions there for how to take it all the way to high level. And it might not be fighting the level three stat block anymore, but they're still there and they're still part of the story that you're taking place in.
And you could also like arrange these in such a way, right? That you go up to the next one, you go up to the next one, and you just keep hunting down the next monster. You could do 20 levels of this. And even those like in between spaces, it's like, well, we're researching the next one we're gonna fight, and like maybe there's another group that we have to chase there that's also trying to hunt this creature down and all that stuff. You can definitely do something.
This would be like a good one season anime where like each is a 4-episode part where we take on a different monster.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
All right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we have some questions in chat and some interesting things. One of them is Kitsune Warlock brings up, pick one monster from this book each to slay, become, or marry / ally with. And I've been thinking about this, so I'm gonna go first, so that's okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I would definitely want to become, and I'm gonna forget her super cool name here, Ulistool. So she is this like construct lady from the Jiska Imperium who was amazing at constructs and turned herself basically into one, and now keeps searching for more construct knowledge. And she looks super cool. So I would like to be her. I think my best friend in the world is going to be the most amazing kitty, the amazing and legendary Lion of Tal'Dor, whose name I also can't remember.
Gragasant.
Yes. I would have just my happy kitty companion, which is great because like I'd be super lawful as a construct and then my cat is super chaotic because it's a cat, but we'd still get along. It'd be like a odd couple. And then I want to slay.
Yeah, that's a face for a best friend.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to marry a cat. That's weird. But I would be best friends with them. All right. And then I would slay
mm-hmm.
a kaiju.
Oh. Yeah.
I want to slay big. A kaiju. Yeah. Go big or go home. And I mean, I'm already home, so I can't do that. So I'm gonna slay a kaiju. Epic.
Luis?
I think I would slay Kothagai, the spawn of Ruvagug that's in here. Just cause the idea of the earth turning into giant pustules that erupt into countless insects. I'm not really into that. So I think getting rid of that once and for all would be kind of pretty good. I think I would become, that one's a little tricky. I think I'll go with Tal'Jay, who's the Tian Sha one with the masks. Just being able to swap masks and do lots of different abilities is really cool. And then also Tao Jie like isn't evil. They're just kind of chaotic and do what they want and kind of a trickster, and that's kind of fun. So I'd prefer not to be just a straight up evil monster. And I think I'm, hey, I'm a nice guy and I don't want to do mean things.
And I just want a magic robot body.
I would ally with Ketsmonkwali, the big lizard. Because it'd be fun to ride that big goofy looking lizard guy. He's a little goofball. Look at him. He's very cute.
The lizard is a nice touch. For me, for sure, my kill would actually be Ketsmonkwali, because he just seems like that seems super, super sinister. And I would just have to hope that I don't want to grab me big old sphere of some evil army.
Yeah.
I would ally with the I'm gonna miss this
Ainamorin.
Ainamorin, because he needs a friend real bad.
That's like true.
Canonically, super needs friends.
Yes,
and also he looks like he'd give good hugs.
I mean, probably cold hugs, but good ones.
That's fuzzy. Like I imagine that there's got to be some way that they can warm up, literally. And as far as become, well, this answer was obvious the very second that they ever showed up. The one, the only, Mogaru.
Oh, yes.
Of course.
Mainly because I like naps and not being disturbed. There's this really cool piece of the lore that there's areas in this book that details that they're mostly desolated and isolated. Not because the kaiju picked locations to be desolated and isolated. But the never means that other people choose not to.
That's true. It's like, oh, it's this beautiful house by a mountain. That's not a mountain. What? No, it's just a giant lizard. It's fine. There's some dirt on him. Doesn't matter. He's asleep. He's not gonna wake up. I am leaving right now. I am not visiting you.
Plus, I would only have one job, which would be to get in awesome wrestling matches with other giant monsters.
Oh my god. It's like Monster WWF.
And having two tails is better than one.
It's true.
Any other questions from chat? Yes. Which monster is your personal nightmare? This is coming from Alicia Kills.
I think I'm still going to go with Katha guys. There's a lot of weird, gross looking monsters in here. And some of them I find very endearing, in fact. Like, I know there was there's a lot of reactions with Coercis, the big hand looking one, where people don't like it and are very creeped out. But I think he's kind of a sweetie. So I think
it's just a cousin thing.
He's just he just wants to, he's trapped in a maze and needs help getting out and just wants your help. So I think Kathagaz being the big ultimate death bug is probably the one I'd go with.
It definitely seems like the most evil of all of them.
Yeah. And it's a literal spawn of Rogue.
I think some Nalu would give me too many nightmares. I mean, it's that lizard with the big eye and all the little eyes, and he's just, it's creepy.
For me, the mosquito witch is the one that's given most of my characters nightmares. It's one of the first one of these that we've canonically gotten to do anything with. Like, you become within a hair's breadth of the mosquito witch in Pathfinder Society if you're not careful.
That's true.
So the other aspect of this book is that there are a couple of character options scattered throughout here. Most of them are terrible because they're balanced badly or not flavor for interacting with these options. Terrible has happened in your vicinity. Could you tell us a little bit about like what that was like, bringing in some of these, like the spear of nope, don't touch it, or hey, I'm going to take on this giant Yeti curse.
Well, the fun thing about a lot of the Lost Omens books is that usually there's a lot of leeway given to the authors to say, hey, if you want to include some rules options for players, go for it. I think the outline requested, give us some mechanics. It can be like an extra stat block, you know, so something like the Young Lenorm stat block that shows up with Faf in here, or the alternative Krampus Celebrant for Krampus, or it can be, you know, some additional abilities that a monster could have. The Callous Devils has some like ones that you can swap out if you prefer, or it can be stuff that players can earn by defeating these creatures. So, you know, everyone kind of had their say in what they wanted or didn't want as their extra options here. And I think it turned out well. A lot of these are amazing rewards, I think, for encountering these monsters. The ultimate dragon slaying sword is pretty cool. We'll just ignore entirely that you have to basically slay the ultimate dragon anyway to get it in the first place. There's a lot of interesting options that just, I think the options themselves even tell their own little stories and lend to adding to the mythic flavor of each of these creatures, which I think is really what you want, because you could just be like, oh, well, here's a random strong piece of armor that doesn't, it's just, it has no connection to them, but making sure that they are tied to them or serve as rewards or something that you have to defeat these monsters or at least win them over and convince them to help you out with like Animur and giving you the archetype. It just adds to the possibilities for adventures and adds to the greater story.
Another common theme with these monsters, and I guess this is ties into, hey, why are they still monsters of myth, is a good many of them, killing them leads to bad things for the people that kill them.
Right?
Like the monster he's going to maybe you reincarnate in your body is maybe a bad thing. Maybe. Also, like, I do like the idea with Fafnir. One of my favorite parts of that is the fact that killing Fafnir makes you the king of all Lenorm kings may have been invented by Fafnir so that he has a supply of free lunch. Which is a fantastic little bit of lore. I love that concept. But there's a lot of commitment to going after some of these monsters, and some of them may be gotchas or more than likely researched ahead of time. Like, why is that in here? Like, why is like the idea that maybe you don't want to fight this thing and win part of the equation?
I think part of it is some of these are definitely just there to like keep the monster around for generations and generations worth of time, right? Like Quetzman Kali keeps coming back because someone claims the spear. And it's not destroyed, so it brings him back to life. So that explains why he's been around for thousands of years. That's why Fafnir has been around for thousands of years. Maybe someone did kill him, but they exploded into a new Lenorm, right? A brief explanation as to how these things have survived for so long, having an ability like that helps out. And then another thing is just like, it's research fodder. It's legend fodder, right? Like legend lore specifically fodder. Learning that Fafnir's death curse means that you explode into a new Fafnir is an important thing to learn, and maybe an important lesson to learn as players if you just run in swords a-blazing, I guess, in this case. So I don't know. I think a lot of monsters in not just in tabletop game, but a lot of monsters have ways that they come back or do like the last aha, you thought you killed me, but I'm gonna lash out before I finally die kind of thing. And it's just kind of a staple of monsters like this throughout folklore.
And also I also like that it does give some weight to some of the medium monsters. Like if a high level character does like show up, that was easy, oh wait, I'm cursed to what? And that can become the emphasis for its own little adventure. But how many of you trust your players to like not grab the spear of lead the horrible army of fire?
Well, I mean, you might
someone's
going
to grab it.
Yeah, you might grab it intending to destroy it. And, like all great stories where someone intends to destroy a great artifact, suddenly, corruption sets in or greed or lust for power. And then you got a whole nother campaign ready.
You're like, well, I'm going to take it, but I'm not going to use it. Okay, all right. Well, now you're up on a really hard fight and spear would kind of be perfect, but you don't have to. Okay, I'm going to use the spear to kill this one creature or I'm going to die and then I can't destroy it because I'll be dead. So obviously I'm going to use it. Well, okay. You just keep drawing them in a little bit more.
So V, how would you use some of these monsters in your campaigns as a fantastic game master that I know?
Well, I don't know. I would ask a fantastic game master and, they're so good. I kind of like the idea of using probably not all, there's a lot of them here, but maybe half of them, maybe a third of them for like a Monster Hunter game. Like you could go after Spring-Heeled Jack, right? You'd be a little level one character. You're like, let's all be Monster Hunters. This would be super cool. We could be super famous. And so you take down Spring-Heeled Jack and you're like, yeah, we're really cool. And then you go into the next bigger and better thing until you have all these, like all this pressure. And then someone's like, okay, go kill Fafnir. Wait, no. He'll kill us. Even if we kill him, he'll kill us. We can't do that. And they're like, but you're the Monster Hunters, right? Or what was that one? The Spun a Rogue of a Gog one. I'm so bad with names. They all have bizarre names. Carthagaz, yeah. So it's like, Carthagaz has risen and is destroying all these things. You're the famous monster hunter. Go get them. And they'd be like,
We're level six.
We're level six. You know, or even if you played a bit, yeah, and you're like, okay, well, so we're level, 10. We're pretty good, but we can't take that thing down. That's probably how I would do it. I would use it to put PCs in a position where I know that they're over their heads, and also kind of make them think about not how am I going to go in with fight a spawn of Rovagug at level 10, because we can't defeat that thing. It's knocking over buildings. But instead think, how can we do something else that's gonna calm it or contain it or summon something big enough that'll kill it, whatever it is that they come up with, and just trying to solve this problem other than, well, let's just roll initiative and see what happens. That's what I would do.
I do like that we do see some returning faces and some familiar beasties in here. Because there's 20 monsters in total. A good chunk of them, this is the first time I've seen them or even referenced.
Well, half of them are existing monsters, and then the other half are brand new.
Okay, so it's divided straight down the middle then.
Yeah.
So, we have the Sandpoint Devil has returned, and that is definitely the first cryptid of Galarian would indeed be the Sandpoint Devil, so it's good to see them returning. Different art for this one. Spiritual ghost horsey this time, instead of, the nightmare feel that.
Because it's not before. The regular Sandpoint, it's the Spectral Devil, right? It's like the ghost of this thing.
Which is bad.
Yeah, the Sandpoint Devil stats are already in Bestiary 2, so why? Yes. You can go look in that book for
that's the adventure I want to run. I take it back, everything I said. I want to do a Sandpoint Devil. I want the group of people that are there to take down the devil. That's what I want.
And then there's a familiar face that three of us have experienced taking down, Krampus.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
This time not at all transformed into a duck. I think he'd get pretty upset if I tried that again.
Yeah, if you do want what in the world did we call that series?
It was Seasons Beatings.
Seasons Beatings. If you want an actual play of us taking on Krampus and many other holiday themed monsters, GM'd by Alex Agunis, that was a fun.
That was so much fun. Sessions. That was great. I love that. I'd play that again.
I already mentioned the Mosquito Witch was something that has terrified my Pathfinder Society players for the past couple of years already, and they are don't want anything to do with that anymore. So yeah, so it's really good to see a good returning crew getting their expanse in addition to the new one. And you've done with this book what I've really loved with PF2 and the latter half of PF1, where this is really broadening the scope of where to see these monsters. There's Arcadia monsters in here. Of course there would be Arcadia monsters. Mm-hmm. There's Voodra monsters in here. There's monsters all over the place. At first I was a little bit worried that the monsters would be so spread out that you couldn't have a world hopping. You would have to have a world hopping campaign to fight them. But thankfully, a lot of these monsters are also close to. All right. So any parting thoughts for this book before we put this one to bed?
I think maybe talking about one or two of our favorites each.
Okay.
Might be good. I can give our breakdown on each of those.
All right.
I would say, pick one new one and one old one, but that's also asking for you to know what the 10 old ones are. So
yeah, that might be a stacked deck against us.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know, just talking about one or two of your favorites and maybe why.
So go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Go ahead.
I like Spring Hill Jack a lot. The opening of it, where it's the series of case files, and then you find out there's not one Spring Hill Jack. It's actually a super rare type of fae, and how that can lead into things, and the fact that you can introduce this concept of mythical things that you do not know enough about to know for sure what's going on. Early on is one of my favorites, and my other favorite would I'm gonna have to go with, I like the Mosquito Witch because it definitely leads into this whole, this is a looming threat ? That there's a lot going on here. It's scary, it messes with your head, there's a lot to tie in with it. It's definitely gross and creepy. And I like that it doesn't just it doesn't just lend itself to a big bad fight. A lot of these lend themselves to more than just, hey, we're going to build up to a bad fight, we're going to have it. Many of these do. Many of these have that option, but a lot of these have, hey, you're going to have to deal with the broader implication that something like this exists in the world and has caused damage that isn't fixable by hitting it with the pointy metal sticks.
Yeah. So I was really hoping that someone would write something in a very SCP case file style. And wouldn't you know it, Ron Lundeen pulled through with the Springheel Jack one. I think in development, I added a little, one of the entries, because in layout was a little short, I added the bit about the break-in report and made sure, as a further allusion to SCPs, to redact something.
Yeah,
because you got it. But I think I really liked about the Mosquito Witch is just how many answers there, how many questions it doesn't answer.
Mm-hmm.
Like the, I think the whole thing about the scenario was just like, we're not sure what it is. Is it even real? Is that a thing? And then this entry just continues like, I don't know, what could it be? Here's like three things it might be, but we don't know if it's that either.
And I want to, I didn't put the asterisk in that point. In any other book, I would be calling this out as like bad writing and like, don't do this with RPG settings. Like, don't give me a whole bunch of entries where, what's the truth? We don't know. Well, then why did I pay for this book? I want to know the truth. It's the GM, so I can use this. I can make stuff up on my own. But with this book and with cryptids and with myth, especially myth, that is exactly what you need. You need this sense of unknown and tweaking it and letting the GM personalize it and not providing all the information. Where and that's not always a bad thing, but it's something that if is overdone in other types of monster books. Like every third monster, nobody knows where it came from. Well, then why on earth am I reading about it? But in a book about myth and a book about cryptids and a book about mystery and finding it out, this absolutely belongs. And that's why I wanted to put an asterisk in that that talking point earlier.
I'd say my two are the Sandpoint Devil, because as Param, as you said, the Sandpoint Devil is the original Galarian cryptid, right? We've all heard all these legends about it since Rise of the Rune Lords, and it's come up several other times when we're back in Sandpoint for various reasons. And it's this elusive sort of weird thing that was kind of like, why is there there's no reason for Sandpoint Devil to be in Rise of the Rune Lords. It's just part of the local lore. And it's one of those things that, I don't know, I have personally been intrigued by it. It's always been one of those things like, if I'm running Rise of the Rune Lords, you're going to fight the Sandpoint Devil. Like, you're going to at least see it or information about it. Like, I'm going to put that in there. And it has nothing to do with the AP's storyline, but it doesn't matter. It's going in there anyway. And so it's just something that's always intrigued me. And so right away, that is one I'm pulling out, right? That's one I want to use. And I really like all the additional lore that this puts in it, in terms of like where it may have been birthed from and the pit and what's in there and all the other creatures and like all the other things that this sort of leads to. And I would love someday to run like a locals from Sandpoint. We're going to hunt down the Sandpoint Devil, you know, some 20 somethings that think they're going to become adventurers all of a sudden instead of, you know, lumberjacks and fishermen or something. So I think that's super cool. The other one is really cool for a dumb reason, which is just, Ulitsul, who I mentioned is the one I would become because I'd be a cool robot lady. She's just really neat. And I know she's evil or whatever, sure, fine. But it's like, I don't know, I always thought that magic robots are super cool and I like using them. And she's the ultimate magic robot, right? She's like, she knows all this stuff and she's making all these other automations, but they're not very good. And the art's beautiful. I don't know. I think she's really cool. Awesome.
I mean, I love robots as well, so I don't fault you at all for that.
Yeah, but your two favorite, Luis?
I think this is such a hard thing. Like, I'm especially like tied to the book, you know, having developed it and written one of them. So I won't say Quetzalcoatl as much as I love him. You know, I wrote that. I don't think it's fair to pick one. But there's a lot of like runner ups, a lot of honorable mentions. If I'm only picking two. Like Olgrimax and the big scary undead crocodile is great. And I like Tal Jay and I like the Callisto. There's just too many. I think I would pick Tehealai, which is the big crab lobster crustacean thing that is the thief of boats in the Okaya Ocean. Partially because it's a different type of creature. It's not something land-based. It's an aquatic creature. So that lends itself to a different type of adventure and campaign and stuff. And I just love how the entry was written in, you know, telling the story of a dance that explains the history of Tehealai and kind of serves as like an offering to Tehealai to allow for greater journeys, another year of good journeys and stuff across the sea and stuff. I think it was just beautifully written. I was very emotional after reading it the very first time. I thought it was really great. So I think, you know, kudos to James Case for having written what I feel is probably a very personal and very interesting entry. And then the other one I would go with is Desert's Howl. Desert's Howl, a big part of it is just how nasty of a monster it is stat-wise. The, you know, having a 10-mile fear aura is just ridiculous, right? Like, 10 miles is enormous. And it has,
a silly amount of aura.
Like, 8 different abilities that just, like, compound and build up on each other to make, like, a terribly dangerous monster. Like, even if you take it on as a 19th level party, it's a level 19 creature, it would be kind of a tough customer to deal with, even if it's, you know, your same level. Like, it's just got a lot going for it, especially if it's taking the time to stalk you throughout the desert. And I think it's just another really well-written entry. I like the history and just the, you know, the ability to have it around from level one is just something that's been tormenting you for your entire career. And sometimes the lesser versions show up, and eventually when you get up to it, it's still not going to be easy. You know, it's if your frightened condition doesn't go away until you get a chance to go to bed for the night, it's rough. It's going to be a terrible time.
Also, taking another look at Desert's Howl, I realize we had answered a question on this podcast incorrectly. We were asked which monster was the best nightmare fuel, and the answer is Desert's Howl, because Desert's Howl has an ability called nightmare fuel. Making it the de facto correct answer.
Yes.
All right. So I overall stick entry into the Lost Omens line, I think.
Would you
would
you recommend this book for every Lost Omens reader?
Oh. This is not
necessarily a review, but like, you know, so, how do you feel? Because we're all GMs, I feel, more so than we are players. So it very much scratches a lot of itches for us at the table. But it's not just GMs out there reading these books.
Yeah, I don't know that this is I would recommend this for everyone. In fact, I would, if your GM is intending to use any of this as a player, stay the heck away from this book. So check with your GM before buying this book, if you're a player, for sure. But if you're a GM and you're enjoying the campaign, say anything, I think that this is a fun, good read. It's definitely not like Lost Omens Legends or Mwangi Expanse level. Oh my gosh, this book is a must read for every Pathfinder player. But it's still a solid book. It's definitely one that makes me like the warm fuzzies for what the old campaign setting books and the old Chronicles books were like. So it's a great, enjoyable read. This is definitely for, I'm more into the lore story possibilities than I want a big old book full of big old beefy monsters. That's here. You're going to get 20 big old beefy monsters. Do not worry. But like, if you're looking for a new bestiary, you know, there's other options out there. But if you're looking for a really cool set of flavorful encounters and inspirations for campaigns, this is great. And I really like that. And it really leans, especially for GMs that are wanting to, like, hey, like, we don't, the default assumption for Pathfinder isn't Adventure Paths anymore or PFS anymore. I mean, not that there ever was, but like, you might have been, hey, maybe you did Plaguestone and it's time to move on from Plaguestone. And maybe now you've got some confidence to do some like your own adventure. This is a book that definitely leads that, because, you know, hey, your party members are a little bit higher level. Maybe they can handle some bigger stuff. Maybe it's time to start hinting of some greater threats that you can play on. Like, you know, throw in the Desert Howl and like, you know, it really messed them up. Then go on to a different adventure. Then come back to Desert Howl. These make good B-plot villains that can sprinkle into campaigns while the players are currently doing other things that continue to come back and back and back. In fact, I think that the weakness would be, it would be a lot of work as a GM to have to invent an entire campaign around these monsters. Whereas I think they are indeed, maybe this book's best use is to be seasoning on the side of other adventures, like the Sandpoint Devil was often used in Rise of the Rune Lords as such.
Yeah, I think you can definitely use it that way. I would recommend GMs use it the way I was talking about it at first, where if you're some sort of hybrid of like, I don't want you to tell me everything to do in the adventure path because I'm going to make my own darn game. But at the same time, you don't want to have to create everything from whole cloth. I think there's fantastic material in here for you to get inspired and go, oh, I know what I can do with this. And as you read through it, you're going to see monsters, you're going to see scenarios, you're going to see situations specifically for the different monsters that you go, now that's an interesting idea. Maybe we can do a kaiju campaign, but we're going to do it at level like 2. And you're not going to defeat the kaiju. That's not what it's about. The kaiju's there. It's doing bad stuff, but it's about the aftermath, right? It's about trying to pick up after it, trying to survive, right? This is a survival game. And the kaiju, like you were saying, are sort of on the side. They're the reason you have to survive, but they're not the thing you're going to fight. Or you know, you might see a creature that you're like, yes, everyone roll up 10th level characters. We're going to go after this big monster. Cool. And I think that's really where this book, I think, has its best use, not necessarily the highest amount of readership, because I think it's a great book just to read through and see the lore and go, ooh, isn't that cool? Mm-hmm. But I think the best use of this book is for those GMs who want to make their own game, but just need a prompt, just needs a push in the right direction, and in order to get some momentum and get some
money. All right. With that, we're going to be moving on to news and banter right after this. V, help us out here.
Pathfinder news. Pathfinder news. Pathfinder news.
There's one more.
What? No, there's three. There's four?
There's four.
Pathfinder news!
Fantastic. Thank you, V.
There was rule of three.
In the Pathfinder news section, we talk about all that's going on and awesome in the Pathfinder and Pathfinder news sphere. And we only have really one story to talk about today, and it is a fairly big bombshell. Mark Seifter, a veteran Pathfinder designer, has been hired by Roll for Combat full time to head up their role playing games line as senior developer. No, director of game design, not senior developer. Director of game design.
Director of game design. And
oh my goodness, if you want to know like super deep dive into it, we actually did get to scoop this thanks to Stephen for giving us the heads up, and we got an interview with Mark and Stephen. But hey, that's some big news. First, Roll for Combat, what is not like immediately game design line is not immediately comes to mind, though they've been doing a heck of a lot of that lately with RPG Superstar and the Battle Zoo line. And secondly, you know, Mark was pretty and is pretty fundamental to what made Pathfinder 2. So, you know, it's a big shift, a big seismic change a little bit here.
It is.
What are your initial thoughts? I've already got to talk a lot about this a little bit earlier. So V, what are your thoughts?
Actually, I'm going to let Luis go first because I know my thoughts and I have a little bit of inside baseball on it. So I'm going to go next. But Luis, what do you think about this change?
It's not like Luis has any inside baseball here.
Well, I know, but it's from a different perspective, right? Like, because I work with Steven at Roll for Combat. So that's, I have a different perspective on it.
Okay. Well, welcome to the first episode, Luis, that you have to discuss this rather difficult news story.
Yeah. I've worked a little here and there with Mark Seifter at, I don't know, what's he called? Paizo. And no, he's literally the lead designer for this book, Monsters and Myth, and the last Lost Omens book, and every Lost Omens book that's ever come out. He's in that credit page for each of those. So I've worked directly with Mark for a long time. And I think the biggest thing that first comes to mind is I'm going to be very sad to not get to work with Mark in the same capacity moving forward. I mean, I have him around for a few more weeks, and I'm hopefully going to like pump him for as much design insight as possible before he goes, and maybe like pull him aside and be like, help me. We're going to errata every Lost Omens book before you go or something. But I mean, it's an exciting thing because Mark is the managing designer, I think official title, kind of in charge of you know, schedules and figuring a lot of the book planning out already. So it's not like he doesn't know how to do that. He'd just be moving up to a position where he's just kind of free to do so, just do so more freely. So that's very exciting to see what he's going to do. I mean, I've seen the dragon, what I know of the dragon ancestry he's written, it's exciting. It's something he was wanting to do for a long time independently. So he got this opportunity to do it. And I think it bodes well for roll for combat as well. I mean, you get one of the guys that wrote the literal rule book for Pathfinder 2E, right? He wrote those, he was there. And that's huge. And I think it also means that there's the potential for a great flourishing of the third party environment for Pathfinder 2E, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, not to say that there aren't third party companies out there, but it definitely feels like it's taking a bit longer for third party recognition on the fan base side to kind of build up compared to what was happening with first edition. There were a lot of companies kind of just out of the gate with first edition Pathfinder, and 2E has had a couple there, but I feel like having more out there would be great. And then having Mark as the guy that maybe it does your development pass and gives you feedback as a third party writer and brings you up to speed, is invaluable, right? And it's going to do a lot of good for Pathfinder as a whole, the entire environment, not just for Roll for Combat, but for anyone that's wanting to buy any Pathfinder products or look at any. These people are hopefully going to be reforged in the Mark Seifter furnace and be ready to go out and just absolutely kill it on Pathfinder Infinite or be the next person that Paizo hires for a Lost Omens book or something like that. And it'll be amazing. It's just going to do more good for the whole community, the whole Pathfinder sphere as a whole.
And yeah, I do hope that this does result in a lot of that, because I do get frustrated with how easily a lot of the community dismisses some of the third party mm-hmm. stuff out there, considering that when I think about most of the people publishing third party stuff for Pathfinder second edition for Starfinder right now, they are like incredible game designers, many of which are hired frequently by Paizo to write the very first party material that everybody loves. And then it's like, just because it couldn't fit into Paizo's production schedule doesn't mean that this isn't automatically wonderful stuff. I mean, that dragon stuff looks amazing. Battle Zoo Bestiary was great. The adventure path they're working on is some of the most exciting stuff I've seen in adventure path. So like, I'm super excited for what Roll for Combat is putting together here, and that they are taking a little bit of a different tack. It's almost like they're Starfindering Pathfinder 2 material a little bit, with like an emphasis on more crazy out there fun stuff. A lot of what I like about the Lost Omens line, indeed, like it really embraces the fun possibilities that Pathfinder 2 can bring to the table, instead of focusing on what we've traditionally always done with the game in the setting or maybe a tradition. And I want there to be more of that. And I do speculate that, you know, Pathfinder 2, you know, had an uphill battle with adopting its fan base. You know, there was always going to be a resistance to change for the addition of the game that exists to not change in some ways. That is definitely part of its pedigree. And secondly, that, you know, the Pathfinder 2 is a brand new system. It is a lot to take in, a lot to understand. And if you weren't one of the people that helped design and make and one of those very first batch of freelancers, it's not immediately able to grok it, whereas the original Pathfinder built itself off of 11 plus years of the mm-hmm. D20 system being a well understood, documented, and designed for. There was a robust third party infrastructure before that game never even launched, and that isn't true for Pathfinder 2 because it is such a departure from the original D20 system.
Well, and the reason that Pathfinder, first edition was so popular was because it took the D&D 3.5 system and said, hey, we're going to update it and continue it. And so many people like that system, which is basically what I think a lot of third-party publishers, at least some of the ones I've spoken with and people in that writing sphere, are like, hey, if we still want to play 3.5 / Pathfinder First Edition, if we still want to play Pathfinder First Edition, if we still want to tell those stories and write for it and create new mechanics and just keep creating for it, well, now third-party publishers, the only way you can go, and a lot of those third-party publishers that are very used to developing, designing, and publishing for Pathfinder First Edition have been really reluctant to move to a second edition, because I think part of it is like not being familiar with the rules, sure, but also it's like not necessarily knowing if I do this, is it going to break the game? If I do this, is it going to be too powerful? If I do this, is it even going to be popular? Because this is a new system. And I think Battle Zoo being out there, releasing all this content, is really just busting it wide open for third parties to be like, hey, this is a place that you can actually be successful, because so far the stuff has been very well received. You know, it's also very well designed, but there's a lot of designers out there who I think want to write more third-party content for second edition, and this is showing those third-party publishers, hey, it's okay to do that, and you can sell it. The other reason I am really excited about this is not just for the effects on the third-party community, but just because knowing Roll for Combat, I'm on one of their actual plays, I chat with Steven all the time. One of the things that's really interesting is seeing Steven go from, hey, I guess I'll just do a podcast because that would be fun, like an actual play, and then saying, I could pick up RPG Superstar. That was super cool. That would be fun to manage that process. And then turn that into a book and get excited about publishing and say, let's just do more. Let's do Indigo Isles, and let's do a new setting, and let's do all this stuff, and let's do dragon campaigns, and just like getting very excited about it. And some of the most wonderful, creative storytelling settings, everything, the most wonderful things you can get are from someone who's excited about it. And that is actually one of the coolest parts, is seeing Steven just get really excited about this. And during a lot of this time, he keeps, you know, hiring Mark as a freelancer to be like, oh, and Mark helped design the monster part system, and Mark helped design all these dragons and the dragon ancestry, and Mark helped design all this stuff. And finally just being like, you know what, I'm just going to hire Mark full time, because he's been so invaluable to this process. And I think the two of them, especially working together on this stuff, it's going to be really cool. And I am very much looking forward to seeing this all come out. And from the looks of chat, other people are too. I saw, I think it was Jana B, talking about how just having another high production value setting with the Pathfinder system is really cool, because like Galarian's cool, but having another perspective and another spin on things is also cool. Like that gives you a whole new chance to explore a new world and a new way of thinking about Pathfinder.
And you're absolutely correct, because like, Steven's a friend. You have a lot to do with Steven, Vanessa. I hang out with him quite frequently, and also am one of the judges for RPG Superstar last time and this time. Are you returning? You're returning for a judge spot too, right, V?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. So like, there's some disclaimers aboard here, but this is a move that was definitely driven by passion and them enjoying working together. It's like I love chatting with Steven. I've never seen him so joyful as him talking about some of the projects they're working on. And so that gives me hope, because I'm always really want, like, I think that the best stuff that comes out of the game design is when you have a group of talented people that just go full passion mode and are just excited about what they're putting together and grateful about what they're putting together. And that's when I start to see the material and the stuff and the books and the products that get me excited. This is what I hope putting Mwangi together was like, Lise. Is that an accurate statement?
And legends.
And
character guide. Yeah.
No, okay. This happens all the time. So the books I keep saying are some of the best books that Paizo's ever made. I have a similar vibe putting into. Yeah. And that's what I'm hopeful that we'll see here with Roll for Combat. Mm-hmm. But things that we do have to address is that, hey, this is great sunshine and roses on that direction. But hey, a lot of people, major players, have left Paizo over the last year, and I'm hopeful that like Paizo was able to, new talent come in, and that's always a part of every company, but definitely over the last year or couple of years, we've seen a lot of the senior big names that have established and created Pathfinder have moved up or moved on, either been promoted out of direct design work, in the case of Jason Bowman, or like the Starfinder team has had a lot of churn, and Mark was very, very influential in what is design, the rules content at Paizo itself. And him and Logan basically were some of the heavy lifters for getting that system written in the first place, or designed in the first place. And that's going to mean there's going to be some changes, and I'm hoping that it's changes for good, but that's still something that's going to have to, I know that Luis, you're limited in what you're going to be able to say here, but but hey, there's going to be some shifts all of a sudden in one of the most important product lines that Paizo puts out.
And yeah, I think, not that it's a good thing that Mark is leaving, right? But Mark has this opportunity, and it's not like he's out of the game industry. You'll never see his name associated with Pathfinder 2 either again. But it does mean that there's now this opening for someone else to come in. And I'm very trusting a design team and everyone else at Paizo that would be part of this process. you know, Jason and Logan and James and Mike would definitely be able to find another great designer to complement that team and bring, who would bring on new ideas, bring hopefully a lot of exciting new mechanics and stuff to the game in a way that, yeah, we might not feel Mark's touch anymore once the last of his products is over with, but we're suddenly going to start seeing new exciting ideas that keep Pathfinder 2E a fun game to play or something, you know. Once we're through, we have 20 classes, right? What's next? You know, there's always going to be something, hopefully, that people are excited for. And having a new voice on the team will, I think, definitely contribute a lot to that. We bring on new freelancers all the time, and we find exciting design and narrative chops among designers all the time. So just getting someone to get to go into that kind of high profile spot and get a chance to big things will hopefully lead to some really fun stuff in the future once that comes down the eventual pipeline in a year or two from now.
And you can definitely expect us to have a mini of probably an interview lined up when somebody moves into that position, because we love to interview the new people.
Yeah, they'll move into their new place and then have already an interview scheduled within the next 2 weeks, based on my experience with all the new people here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on this transition, this news, this new opportunity?
I think
I'm just not going to be waiting in the closet, folk.
I think really the big thing is just, you know, best of luck to Mark, and I'm excited to see what he does. Given the new position, you know, the amount of control he's going to have and say and things. He mentioned a few things to me earlier about stuff he'd like to do in terms of how he handles assignments and freelance coordination and stuff. And some of that, you know, if he manages to pull that off, would be really exciting and might set, you know, new standards for freelancing as on the third party end of things, which could be cool. It'd be good and get a lot more people into writing.
All right. And with that said, I think it's time that we move on to our wrap-ups and shout-outs. V, you ready for this one?
Yeah. Wrap-ups and shout-outs. Wrap-ups and shout-outs. Wrap-ups. Wrap-ups and shout-outs.
And back. Every episode of No Direction, we'd like to throw a little bit of love to some of the other things that are going on and things that we think brought some attention to. And one of the things I want to bring attention to is, Luis, we thought we gave Ryan a good send-off, you know, with the last episode.
Yeah.
But Costello bought 4,000 kind of takes the cake here. Monsters, tell us a little bit about this joyous construction and art.
So Monstrous Physique, I try to line up with whatever happens to be going on at the time. So sometimes, like, if a movie's about to be coming out, hey, new Marvel movie, I'll set up one of the heroes as a character or something. Or, hey, Valentine's Day is coming up, let's do a fun, weird Cupid stat block or something like that. I don't know. You try to hit on something thematically. And the new year was coming up. I thought, okay, I could do a New Year's monster. Yeah, it's a weird time monster or something like that. What else could I do? And just kind of out of nowhere, I had the idea, wait, well, Ryan's leaving, and I don't know if I'm going to make it onto the episode to say goodbye, so I got to do something. It worked out that I did manage to make it on, and I got to do something. And of course, I had this idea like the weekend before, like just about a week before this needed to go up. So I callously reached out to Sheppy. Hey, Sheppy, can you scramble something together? Put something together in like 3 days. And Sheppy was very kind and able to do that. It originally started with, you know, the line art, the sketch line art. That's all we had at the moment to when the original entry went up. But we have this final art that you have pulled up. Very, very wonderful art by Sheppy Rodriguez. But if, you know, Ryan's been such a big part of this and he's helped me a lot through the years, he's been a good friend, I think, and I wanted to give him a nice send off. And what better way than, you know, transform into a monster? It turns out it's not necessarily an evil monster, it's just a big tough robot because we all love big fantasy robots. And wouldn't you know it, this big fantasy robot happens to be a pro wrestler as well. if Ryan was a robot, what would he do? Well, I guess he'd probably be a pro wrestler.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And if you do want to go beat up a Costello bot pro wrestler, it's only CR12. So, you know, a mid-level party can handle it.
It's one level for each year that he was on as a host.
Oh, that's so cool.
This means that my monster will be able to beat his monster.
Yeah,
I mean, eventually. That's really cool.
Right. Luis, anything else you want to shout out to?
Speaking of the third party scene, I think just shouting out Pathfinder Infinite. Go check out Pathfinder Infinite. There's a lot of great stuff on there. And don't be afraid to try your own. Give it a chance. You know, if you're interested in writing something, go for it. It doesn't even have to be, you know, a new feat or anything mechanical. It can be like he's doing. It can be fiction. Or I've seen art that's gone up. There's a lot of the art for the gender flipped deities that's up there that I think is really fun.
Oh, that Micah does. Yes, Micah draws. Yeah.
So just go check it out and find some cool stuff for your game. It's Paizo puts out a lot, but it turns out that when the entire world can contribute, you can get a lot more out of your game. Just usually pretty cheap too. So go check out Pathfinder Infinite.
One more thing I want to shout out to over on No Direction is Fox's Cunning Front. This is from Dustin Knight, ranking the runes. So Dustin has been doing a series of these articles, the Summoner Index, the Ranking of the Runes, that I think are just valuable reference material for all Pathfinder players and game masters to be able to get to. And so in this article, he goes down the armor runes this time, breaking them down, ranking them on how useful they are, explaining how and why you'd want to use them. Honestly, I learned more about the rune system in these last two articles than I have the last 10 times I tried to grok those chapters in the core rollup. So way to go, Dustin. Fantastic article. Love it to death.
Oh yeah, there's some runes in there that I read and thought were super cool and then kind of forgot about. And then now that I'm playing Pathfinder 2 games, I'm like, wait, that one's perfect. How come I'm not using this rune? And so those are really great for just sort of breaking down and figuring exactly what you want to buy. And it's all by level. So you can be like, ooh, that's a level 8. Okay, level 8, I'm definitely picking.
You can't really go wrong with Dustin's guide on pretty much anything. He just knows the system so well that he's got great advice on pretty much anything he's willing to cover. You best be listening to what Dustin's saying.
Speaking of Dustin knowing things, we should have talked about this in news. So Infinite... which is Dustin Knight's product line. Imprint, there you go, that's the word I'm looking for, has been doing these reviews of different material over on Pathfinder Infinite and is now on the official Paizo stream, which is giant, which is humongous.
Like, it's a valuable service to the community because I know that Paizo wants Infinite to be popular and promoted and people know it there, but there's a limited bandwidth available for doing all the advertising and all the community outreach that they do. And so Dustin coming in and being brought in as part of the official channel to or being hosted by the official channel to review all these products and let more people know what's out there is super awesome. I know that it's definitely one of the ways I keep an eye out on what I need to be paying attention to on Pathfinder Infinite. And I'm super glad to see that that's been recognized and getting amplified.
Absolutely. Very well deserved. The reviews are in depth and he talks about why you should purchase each one and how it's useful and the cool sorts of things you can find in there. And it's nice because it's not like, oh, it's someone looking at, you know, what's hot and just reading titles and making assumptions. Like, no, he actually looks through and deep dives them all. And it's pretty cool. He's in chat right now and says, pro tip, buy everything because it's awesome.
Anything else to shout out me?
Dustin, we call that like blanket advice and is no good. So yeah, a couple things we talked about on Infinite. There was this art of gender flipped deities. And that's all from this guy named Micah. You can find him on Twitter at Micah Draws and his stuff is fantastic. And what's really cool is he puts all this art up there for super cheap as sort of like open content sort of art. It's like, hey, buy my art and then use it in your product. Just so cool. And so if you ever wanted gender flip deities, like that's where to go. And then he's got a bunch of other stuff he's selling too. So definitely check that out. The other thing I wanted to shout out to, and mostly because it's something I use probably every single day is a website called pf2easy.com. It is a Pathfinder 2 reference library. It's basically a big database search. And the reference library is literally just like, hey, I'm going to type in the title of something. It doesn't do body text, I don't think. So I can't say, show me everywhere where it says bow staff. But I can look up a bow staff and it says, here's what it is. And here's the critical effect, by the way. And if you have a creature or something, like creature stat blocks have buttons to make them elite or weak, or what's that spell do? And you can click on it and it'll show you. And this is so useful all the time. And that's just cracking the surface. The other thing I love it for is spell books. As an author, an adventure writer, a designer, there are all sorts of times where I'm like, I want to see every single spell in the game that exists so far that's at least been published by Paizo that has the water trait. And I can just do that and whoop, hip, there's all the water spells, and then pick out the right one for the creature I'm designing or whatever it is that I'm doing. And it's just so cool that like it's got all this versatility. So go check it out. That's pf2easy.com, and take a look at it. And if it's something that you like, there's a Patreon so you can support him to keep uploading more stuff. And like, looks like the last thing he updated was Monsters of Myth in December 19th. So he keeps it pretty up to date.
Awesome. Yeah, this is definitely one of the tools that if you are somebody that keeps a laptop at the game table, you really want to have this one as a tab.
Oh, yeah. My cell phone has a perma window open on it. I just open Chrome and there it is.
Luis, anything more to shout out from you?
No, I think that's it for me. I'll find some other stuff to shout out, I'm sure, in the future.
I want to give a shout out to the podcast I'm hosting tomorrow, which is the Printer Games podcast. We've got an interview with Cobra Mode Miniatures tomorrow, and it is they make just pure art. Let me just pull up their website. They make some of the most like it's like moth people with that are like riding salamanders and like snail vendors and chefs, and they all come with like RPG stats, and they're just like it's in a world filled with grim dark stuff. It's just like these are really invented fantastical characters that they make, and they have like a whole like RPG world associated with all of them that you get each month when you support them on Patreon. And so we're gonna have an interview with that team tomorrow over on the Printer Games podcast, and I'm super excited about it.
Do we want to?
But you know what else I'm excited? Oh, sorry.
I was gonna say, do we want to shout out things?
Yes, that's the other thing I'm excited about. The other podcast we're going to be doing, like, in a few minutes, the Patrons Private Sanctum, where it's the podcast for our patrons, directed by our patrons. If you want to participate and just get in on the No Direction After Party, where we'll talk about whatever you ask us to talk about, it's become easily my favorite part of doing these shows at No Direction, getting to hang out with the fans, you know, directly. You can do so by supporting us over on Patreon at patreon.com/nodirection. Make sure you link up your Discord account, and you'll be able to hop in our Discord server, the chillest place for the Paizoverse to hang out, for sure. And you can hang out with us there and join us after every episode of No Direction for the Patrons Private Sanctum. Also, we would really appreciate any support we could get on Patreon right now, especially moving into the new year where travel is something we might actually need a budget for. We are unlocking a travel budget over on Patreon, and that would go a great way for helping our team get to these and continuing the wonderful coverage of these conventions that you all have learned to love here at No Direction. Something that's only possible thanks to our patrons and the dedicated work and sacrifice of the No Direction crew who have... both of you have joined me at some of these efforts, and V, you've been in the trenches for those like 12-hour days and
yes,
3 days before Gen Con, just sweating and making and wondering, why doesn't HDMI work? Is it HDMI cable? Why am
what's
I right?
What's wrong with it
on this camera?
I have a picture of it here somewhere if I can find it. Continue on.
So if you want to do that or to find any of the wonderful content that we have at No Direction, including blogs nearly every day. Oh, yeah. the Nightmare Factory behind Vanessa. you can do so over at NoDirectionPodcast.com, where you'll find this show, No Direction Beyond, Intrepid Heroes. You'll find Legend Lore. You'll find so much wonderful, wonderful content and podcasts that I can't even shout them all out into an outro over at NoDirectionPodcast.com. Make sure you check us out, where you'll find links to our Discord and our Patreon. So until next time, I'm Jefferson J. Thacker, also known as Param.
I'm Vanessa Hoskins.
I'm Luis Loza.
You can always... Oh, wait, I was about to do the private sanctum. You want to find the path, No Direction.
Which leads to the private.